So tonight we'll talk about wisdom literature. And next week we'll be talking about apocalyptic literature, but we'll kind of focus on the book of Revelation and spend a little bit of time there. It probably will not be satisfying because it will not be enough time to cover apocalyptic literature appropriately, but I'll give you some general guidelines that you can use. And then we're going to take a break until probably after the first of the year, because we have the holidays all coming up, and that'll give me a chance to put together some material on the Holy Spirit. And the elders have asked me if I would do a class on the Holy Spirit. So I'll be putting that material together, and we'll start after the first of the year. But tonight, let's talk about wisdom literature. There are, generally speaking, four books in the Old Testament that are classified as wisdom literature. We're only going to talk about three of them. We're not going to talk about the Song of Solomon because, frankly, I don't understand the Song of Solomon very well. I know how to read it on one level, but that's about it. And it just seems like there's a lot of stuff in the Song of Solomon, and I'm not certain that I can discuss it as well as I would like to. So we're going to sort of skip over the Song of Solomon. It's a unique book in the Old Testament, and I wish that I understood it better. I just have to tell you, I really don't. So we're going to talk about the three books. We're going to talk about Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and then we're going to talk about Job. Wisdom literature is kind of a unique literary form. It was a form that was common in the ancient Near East. And I've cited several examples of wisdom literature that are non-biblical wisdom literature. And they kind of help us to understand the range of things that are discussed in wisdom literature. I mean, if you start with Works and Days, that's really a discussion of good agricultural practice. And so Works and Days reads kind of like a farmer's almanac. It's a long poem. There are, I believe it's 858 lines in that poem, but it's basically reflections on how to be a good farmer. Then there are a couple of essays that were written by Cicero. The first one is an essay on aging and death. And if you're really interested in reading some good material on aging and death, get a hold of this that I have listed for you here, Cato Major. Yeah, I shouldn't even try to pronounce that. Anyway, it's the first one that's listed by Cicero. It's an essay on aging and death, and it was written as if Cato the Elder was lecturing his two young mentees on the subject of aging and death. Then there's the second one that's listed by Cicero is three books that Cicero wrote, and he explains in book one what's honorable. In book two, he gives advice on how to maximize personal profit. And then Book three is how to deal with those situations where it looks like what's honorable is not what would maximize personal profit. Then there's Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, 12 books that were, they were private notes that he wrote to himself. So it's kind of like today we write notes to our younger self. Well, that's what this is kind of like. These Meditations, you had 12 books, and they're mostly from the vantage point of Stoic philosophy. But it wasn't just the Near East, although this is where you find a vast majority of this stuff written. Old Norse text. There's a poem from the period of time when the Vikings lived that talks about living and proper conduct and wisdom. During the Renaissance, you had the development of another batch of wisdom literature. You have the first one here that I've listed. That's Latin for the Imitation of Christ. Let's see. Make sure I didn't go through and mute everybody's microphone. The Imitation of Christ, Christian devotional, 4 books, emphasizes inner life and withdrawal from the world, as opposed to what was commonly written then, that was the active imitation of Christ. And you have the Maxims that were written in 1600s. This is not the three books that we have included in the canon. And when I say canon, I'm talking about what we generally accept as the Old Testament canon. You have Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. You had other books that represent this genre of Hebrew wisdom literature. And some of these books are included in the Apocrypha. I don't know if you've ever owned a book, a Bible that has the Apocrypha included in it, but the Book of Wisdom and Ecclesiasticus, these are really good books. They're probably not inspired. It's a little bit hard to tell with these kinds of books, but we're removed from the time when those were circulating. And so I trust those people that put the canon together who had better information about whether these books were generally accepted as inspired. But it's really interesting to read through some of these books. Many of them talk about love and the impact that love has on men. And especially the Book of Ecclesiasticus. Then there's a fourth book that is not included in the Apocrypha, and it's one that we're generally not familiar with, but it is a tractate in the Mishnah, or a chapter in the Mishnah. It's a little bit unique in that there are no laws included in this tractate in the Mishnah, which is very different than what you typically see in the Mishnah. This book is called The Sayings of the Fathers. And again, I have only read little snatches of that one, but it's a very interesting book to read. So when you look at the wisdom literature, it seems like to me, and I get this from a lot of other experts who look at literature, that there are two big kinds of wisdom literature. You get providential wisdom, and that's kind of like, how do you live every day? That's what you find in the book of Proverbs. And then you get what's called speculative wisdom that you find in Ecclesiastes and Job. And the difference between the proverbial wisdom and the speculative wisdom is speculative wisdom kind of deals with the big themes. You know, what's the meaning of life? How do I interpret all of the things that happen in the world? And then the proverbial wisdom is little statements. They're today we would probably call them memes. They're little statements about how to live your life. Then when you talk about the speculative wisdom, it's presented in two different ways. In Ecclesiastes, it seems like it's a monologue that's delivered by Solomon. He's reflecting on everything that's happened. And then you have the book of Job, which is a dialogue either between Job and one of his four friends, or it's a dialogue between God and Job. But these books deal with kind of overarching themes. And so you have to remember what these books are dealing with. It's really easy to, I think, abuse some of the wisdom literature. Rather than reading the whole book, we tend to read just little snatches of it, little bits and pieces, and we don't emphasize what I think is the most important part, which is the overall theme of the book. And it's also very easy to misunderstand some of the language. The word that really strikes you is the fool. And the fool is presented a lot in wisdom literature. The other word that's used a lot in wisdom literature is vanity. So we'll talk about some of those words a little bit more. When we think about the contrast between a wise man and a fool, we're generally talking about practical living. We're not talking about the speculative theories that overarch everything. We're generally talking about practical living. And the wise man lives his life practically with an orientation towards God. So everything that he does with a view to incorporating God and what God would have to say. And that's usually contrasted with the fool, who only pays attention to worldly wisdom. And you see that kind of play out in particular in the book of James, where James talks about pursuing the wisdom that comes from above as opposed to the wisdom that is earthy. And the two are not always the same. Now, in the Old Testament period, you had a class of people that were called the wise men. And we don't know a lot about them. They seem to be people who were wisdom instructors. And a lot of times they talk about them as if they were their mother or their father teaching them wisdom. That makes sense because the home is where we learn a lot of practical lessons in the first place. Our parents are probably our first teachers in terms of wisdom. And we remember all of those things that our parents used to say to us when we were in the home. You know, always wear clean underwear because you don't know whether you'll get in an accident, which I kind of joke about. But my mom taught me wisdom. Children should listen and not speak. They're to be seen and not heard, was the way my mom used to say it. So there's a lot of learning how to get wisdom. And it seems like you have these wisdom instructors that first pop up during the reign of Saul. And it seems like in many cases they served as court counselors, and they would give advice to Saul as he was trying to govern in Israel. And we're familiar with how later Solomon asks for wisdom from God so that he can discharge his responsibilities as a king. And then you get wisdom that comes from debate and discussion. And this is mostly what takes place in the book of Job. You have debate and discussion between Job and his four friends. And sometimes what his friends have to say has a ring of truth to it, and sometimes it doesn't. And they had to debate this back and forth. And Job's four friends are, it seems, constantly dismayed by the fact that Job is protesting that he has done nothing wrong that should have brought this calamity on him that he was now suffering. So let me stop at this point and solicit some input. Any other thoughts about kind of wisdom literature as a kind of literature that's included in the Old Testament? Okay, let's go on to a little bit about the book of Proverbs in particular. Proverbs, I don't know if you've ever tried to write a proverb yourself, but it's really hard to do. These proverbs are memorable advisory statements that people can use to help them when they're making good choices, or when they're making choices, it can help them to make good choices. So it's pretty practical. It's attitudes, behavior in daily life. It's, well, Stuart and Fee say it's a book of old-fashioned basic values. And they're reduced to little tiny statements that are very memorable. But I think it's important for us to remember that these are just basic attitudes, basic patterns of behavior. They're not guarantees of outcomes. And I think about how easy it is to misunderstand or misapply a statement like the statement is made in Proverbs 22 at verse 6. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. Now, all things being equal, that's generally speaking true. But our children have the right to make their own decisions. And sometimes they make decisions that we disagree with. They make decisions that we can't understand. So I think it just makes the point that while these things are generally true, they're not a guarantee of outcomes. It's very dangerous to assign causation. And when I say that, what I mean is I hear people sometimes talk about Proverbs 22 at verse 6, and they see children that have left God, and they say the cause of those children deciding to leave God is that their parents did not train them properly. Because Proverbs 22 at verse 6 says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. If he departs from it, you didn't train him up in the way that he should go. That's a misunderstanding of what these general statements are all about. Now, I can tell you that we have studied kids who apparently left God, or left the religion of their parents, is generally the way that this is studied in sociology. And one of the things that we know from sociology and the study of human behavior is that many times people who leave the religion of their parents return to that religion eventually in their life. But it's a mistaken idea that we can assign causation here. Go ahead.
Lee was talking here earlier when we were talking about Job and his friends. You know, well, they were just sure this earthly wisdom, it was their application, that he had to have done something wrong. I mean, people are always looking to apply something that doesn't necessarily apply.
At fault,
yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And good people make that mistake. That's a mistake that the apostles made in John, the 9th chapter. Remember that they encountered the man that was born blind? And their question to Jesus was, who sinned? Was it this man or his parents that he was born blind? Because in general, we can say that if you live a life of sin, it will produce consequences in your life. I talked to a guy one time whose car had been stolen. And he said, this is the third time my car has been stolen. Every time I park it on the street out in front of the bar, my car gets stolen while I'm in the bar. And if there was a part of me that said, you know, why don't you think about the fact that you're parking your car in a place where it's likely to get stolen? So it would be unreasonable for me to say, the reason your car got stolen is because you parked it in front of a bar. It's not unreasonable to say, if you park your car in a dangerous place, it's likely to get stolen. You know, today, that translates into And I do it all the time. I do it every time I get out of the car. I take my backpack with me. I never leave my backpack in the car, even if I lock the doors, because the practical wisdom of the situation is, if a thief can see something in the car, he's likely to break into the car and try to steal it. So that's kind of practical wisdom. And the real value in these proverbs is that there's a rhythm to it, or some sort of a sound repetition or a vocabulary that makes it easy for us to learn it and repeat it. It's a lot easier for us to learn "look before you leap," as opposed to the way that I would write it if I was writing this down, because I'm verbose and I don't do this well. I would say, in advance of committing yourself to a course of action, consider your circumstances and your options. Better to say, look before you leap. So these proverbs, they're wisdom literature, but they're written so that we'll be able to remember it. And it will always be there for us. And we don't have to think about it for a long time. And it just comes off the tip of our tongue. But because of that, because they were written to be memorable, they're not really a comprehensive statement of everything that could possibly be said about a given situation, or a comprehensive statement of truth. So you take something like Proverbs 25 at verse 24 as an illustration. Better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. You have to translate that. I mean, I don't live in a place where anybody lives on the rooftop. If I lived in old Israel, where they had flat-top roofs, and a lot of times people did live on the roof of their houses, that makes a lot of sense. If I was translating it into today's vernacular, it would be, I'd rather live in a garage than live in a spacious house with a woman that I never should have married in the first place, because she's just a quarrelsome woman. I don't think that this proverb has the impact of giving me instruction on what to do if I find that my wife is being quarrelsome. The instruction is not, well, just resign yourself to living in the attic in your house, or resign yourself to living in the garage. Just don't go inside. So that it's easy to misuse these things. Other comments about proverbs. So we'll take some breaks as we go through this.
Dean?
Yeah.
Talking about the guy who got his car stolen 3 times?
Yeah.
Okay, well, another alternative is, if you look at certain cars, because the resale parts are so, the cost of resale parts is so high that people steal those cars more often. So maybe you don't want to buy a particular kind of car. It might have nothing to do with where he parked it. It might be he just buying the wrong kind of car.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that kind of thing, you know, we do know that there are certain kinds of cars that are stolen more often than other kinds of cars. So you might not want to buy that kind of car. Give me just a minute. Lenny was having trouble with the invitation, so I'm going to resend the invitation to Lenny here for just a second. So give me just a minute while I do this. I have to pay attention to what I'm doing. Oh, I didn't want that. I have to pay attention to what I'm doing here so I can make sure that I get this to happen. Let's see. Okay, I think I got that sent to Lenny. Sorry, when Ted's not here, I get like a one-armed paper hanger. I'm trying to pay attention to too many things and trying to watch my phone and my computer and everything else at the same time.
Dean, he called me a little bit ago and asked me if I would email the invitation to him. Apparently that didn't work. I tried it twice.
Okay.
So now he's still struggling to get internet connection out there.
Okay. I just sent it to him again. He was having trouble opening the document before. So that may be what's implicated in him having trouble opening that.
I also sent the PDF document to him as well. So.
Yeah, he said he did communicate with me and said that he had been able to open the PDF document. So
okay. We
were able to get it that way. But and just for everybody's benefit, when I send out anything in the future, I'll try to send it out as a PDF because I think it's a little easier for everybody to open PDFs than if I send it as a Word document. When I was buying a car the very first time, and here I was 20 years old and I wanted a hot car. Like, I didn't want a car like what Ron Harrison drove when he was 20 years old, but I wanted a hot sports car. And my dad gave me some good advice. He said, whatever you do, don't buy a red car, because red cars get more tickets. I've remembered that to this day. And turns out that's true. It might have something to do with the way that kids tend to drive red cars. But as a meme, you know, there's something to be said for just thinking about that kind of thing. Like Carol said, you may not want to buy a Ford F-150 because that's the most stolen vehicle in the United States. Or if you do, be very careful where you park it, because those kinds of vehicles get stolen a lot. It used to be a Honda Accord. Don't ask me how I know that. So let's go on and think a little bit about Job. Job is, unlike Proverbs, which is prudential wisdom, Job is speculative wisdom. It's thinking about the big questions in life. And this speculative wisdom in the book of Job is expressed as a dialogue that Job has when calamity befalls him. We're familiar with the first part of the book of Job. And then Job has four friends, Bildad, Zophar, Eliphaz, and Elihu, who come and they comfort him. Now, if I had friends like these four, I would get different friends. Because it doesn't, you know, they're trying their best, but they're making all kinds of mistakes. And the biggest mistake, it seems to me, that these four friends make is to think that whatever happens in life does not or they think that it always happens either because God wants it to happen or because it's fair. And that's, you can't make that mistake. What the comforters argued was that the calamity that befell Job was necessarily a direct result of whether or not Job had lived a life that was pleasing to God. It, like I said before, it's the same mistake that the apostles made when they encountered the blind man in John 9. And the question that they asked, who sinned? Was it this man that sinned or his parents? Because he is blind. And we know that if you live a life that is not pleasing to God, you're going to suffer consequences. Now, they took that too far. They made the mistake. But it's the same mistake that Job's friends made. And I think the wisdom comes in understanding the mistake that they represent. Job keeps saying, I have not done anything. In fact, Job's wife says, curse God and die. And Job says, no, I will not do that. And what Job has to say is the epitome of wisdom. It's the epitome of being directed to God. He says, even if God chooses not to bless me, I will still worship God. Now that's a really hard lesson to learn. Even if God doesn't bless me, I will still worship God. And the reason that that's such a hard lesson to learn, and it's part of speculative wisdom, is that in general, if you live a life that's pleasing to God, you will be blessed. But, you know, we understand that it's entirely possible that in our lifetimes, we might see a situation in which people that express any kind of reverence for God are going to be persecuted. And that persecution may be of the type that we read about in the book of Hebrews. I hope that we don't get there. But the end of the book of Job, when Job begins to have his conversations with God, God puts everything back into perspective. You're not always going to understand what I do. And we just have to understand that. So, any other thoughts about the book of Job in general?
Steve?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, his friends were really wise for about a week when they sat and mourned with him and kept their mouth shut. But after they meditated for a week on it, they decided that they knew how to solve his problems and what was wrong, and they couldn't keep their yap shut any longer.
Yeah, they opened up their mouth and removed all doubt.
What was that, Lee?
They opened up their mouth and removed all doubt.
Yeah. Mark Twain was right. Better to keep one's mouth shut and be thought wise than to open one's mouth and be thought a fool. So there's something to be said for that. But I guess I'm like Job's three friends. I have a hard time just sitting with someone who is going through very difficult circumstances. And sometimes that's the best way to be. Okay. Then we get the book of Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes has been described in a lot of different ways. I have read, and I did at one time when I was at Sunnyvale, I had to write a commentary on a book. And so I spent a year writing a commentary on the book of Ecclesiastes. And that seemed like the more I read, the less I understood about the book of Ecclesiastes. There are a lot of people that present their understanding of the book of Ecclesiastes as if it's a very cynical outlook on life. And it's almost like the Stoic philosophy. You need to avoid life because there's just nothing good about it. I tend to think that it's an expression of how to enjoy life under the sun, knowing that we're all going to die. And there's a certain amount of repetition that happens to a man in this life. So you have this structure in the book of Ecclesiastes. Hold on, I just got another email. Nope, not Lenny. There's this structure in the book of Ecclesiastes. There's the first section or the prologue. Then there's the discussion. And then there's the epilogue or the last part of the book. And then there's the conclusion in the last two verses in chapter 12. And I find it really interesting as I look at the book and I try to understand the structure of the book, that in the prologue and in the epilogue, the teacher, which is everybody pretty much accepts as being Solomon, the teacher is talked about in the third person. So he's referred to as he did this. And then when you get to the discussion part of it, that's in between chapter 1 at verse 11 and chapter 12 at verse 8, the discussion part of it, the teacher speaks in the first person. And it's instead of he did this, it's I did this. So how do I understand kind of the book of Ecclesiastes? The book of Ecclesiastes, in my mind, is an expression of the fact that what you see on the earth in the here and now, or what the teacher calls under the sun, what you see here on earth in the here and now is not all that there is. There's an entire existence above the sun. And that makes some sense if you recognize what Hebrew idiom was like. The Hebrews talked about the heavens, and they had different levels of the heavens. You had the first level of the heavens. That's where the birds fly. That's the air. And then above that, you have the clouds. That's the second level. Then the third level is where the stars are. And then that is the level, of course, that includes the sun. But then there's a level beyond that. And that level beyond that is where God lives. That's the spiritual dimension that in reality does exist, but is not always obvious to us while we're here on the earth in the here and now, while we're living under the sun, while our view is restricted to what we can see. The things that are true in that spiritual world kind of escape our notice. They're true, and the world is not just restricted to what's under the sun. So I think that's what keeps the book of Ecclesiastes from being a cynical approach. The cynical approach would be to say that this what's under the sun is all that there is, and if that's all that there is, then eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. If you take a broader view of everything that exists, that includes the things that you can't see. So souls and spirits, angels, God, Satan, those are all things that are very real, but right now our vision is too limited and we just can't see them. So here's how I go about trying to think about the book of Ecclesiastes. There are five things that you have to accept as reality. And some of them are counterintuitive because you can't see them. The first one is God. We can see the impact of what God does, just like we see the impact of the wind. And that's what Jesus explains to Nicodemus. We can't see God, but we can see his impact. So that's the first reality. The second reality is that God's ways are not always understandable. And that might mean that whatever happens in my life is such a small part of the overall scheme of things that are going on in the world that I have trouble understanding why what's happening in my life is happening, because I can't see the end result. I tried to illustrate this one time by talking about something that I learned when I was working in radiopharmacy. We prepared drugs, radioactive drugs, to be injected into people who were having tests done. And in order for me to figure out how much radioactivity I needed to put in the vial, I needed to think about the fact that the drug is declining over time. So I couldn't measure it as if I was measuring it at 4 o'clock in the morning. I had to measure it as if it was going to be injected at 10 o'clock in the morning. And we had a girl that worked in the lab, and she could not comprehend that notion that if you wanted 30 milligrams of or 30 millirads of radiation, that you didn't put 30 millirads in the vial at 4 o'clock in the morning. She just couldn't comprehend that what she was doing at 4 o'clock was a part of a much larger thing that was going to happen that included 10 o'clock, because she couldn't see 10 o'clock. So God's ways are not always understandable. And sometimes it is true that what God knows is good seems to me to be evil. And that I don't discount the fact that it seems to me to be evil. I have to accept that it seems to be evil, but in reality, I think it's good, because God is the single indisputable reality. And because of that, I have to accept that what he determines is good is what's really good. And then the third reality, we've talked about this already, what happens under the sun is not all there is. There is a reality beyond what I can see and touch and taste and the things that I can weigh. And a lot of things that happen in life represent really just the repeated flow of life. Life goes on. Good and evil happen to all men, the righteous and the unrighteous. They happen, it seems like, the same way for everybody. A lot of things that happen represent just the repeated flow of life. And then the last reality is that the great equalizer is death. It is the one thing that happens to all men. Rich people die, poor people die. Smart people die, people that aren't so smart die. Men die, women die. There's really no difference. When you get right down to it, the great equalizer is the concept of death. And then, of course, you have to end with chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. This is the final perspective that you ought to have if you accept these five realities. And if you are willing to accept those five realities, then sometimes you will look at things that are happening under the sun and you will not understand why they're happening, or it will seem like there's no purpose to it. So that's kind of my understanding of the book of Ecclesiastes. And it may be different than your understanding of the book, but I think we're still going to get down to Ecclesiastes 12, verses 13 and 14. That's the be all and end all of the book of Ecclesiastes. And everything in that book has to be understood in terms of the last two verses in the book. So don't, it's very tempting. And I do it without thinking about it. I take little parts of the book of Ecclesiastes and I take them out of the whole and then I try to make something out of it. You know, Solomon's statement, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of mirth. Well, I probably am guilty of misusing that statement because I take it without reference to the whole of the book. Okay. That's all I know about wisdom literature, and I'm not going to deal with the Song of Solomon. So I don't understand that book. I wish I did, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in the Song of Solomon that I probably just don't get to benefit from because I don't understand it, and that's part of that is my fault because I don't understand it very well. I tend not to read it very often. I think if I spent as much time reading and trying to understand the Book of Solomon, the Song of Solomon, as I do trying to understand a book like Romans, I would probably come up with a better understanding of the Song of Solomon. But I have not done that. That's my shortcoming. So. Man, if anyone wants to teach the Song of Solomon, be my guest. I think I'll leave that one for the elders. So any thoughts about wisdom literature before we bring this to a conclusion? I must say that I think Stuart and Fee do a better job of discussing wisdom literature than I do. And this part of the outline probably represents the greatest departure from what Stuart and Fee have said. So spend some time reflecting on what they have written about the wisdom literature. You know, Brenda has joined us a couple of times and made the good observation that we've not talked about biblical information as much as we've talked about trying to have a framework for getting the most out of the biblical information. So we're not spending much time reading the Bible in this Bible class. It's a very different sort of Bible class, but I think it's one that's important for us if we're going to read the Bible and get everything that there is there and be able to capture it in the way that it will do us the most good. So I don't feel like I have to apologize for teaching about the Bible. It's just, it's a little bit different than what we're used to when we talk about Bible class. So we'll talk about the Holy Spirit next time, and you will find that discussion is a lot more focused on the things that the Bible says about the Holy Spirit.